When a client comes into a session feeling like everything is someone else's fault, they can sometimes get stuck in the content of the blame. They get bogged down in the externalization of their blaming, and it can be difficult to move forward. So, how do we help clients begin to shift from a blame mindset to a growth mindset? According to Dr. Shelley Harrell, it starts with how we first approach the client's blame.
My orientation generally is meet the client where they are. So I wouldn't necessarily try to convince them that what they're perceiving is wrong, right? I would really want to hear what that's about. And I think sometimes we so value self-awareness, and obviously I do too. I'm a therapist. I think self-awareness and taking responsibility is important. But I think sometimes we minimize the actual experiences that clients may have in the world that do negatively impact them. All right. So it's not either it's your internal process or it's the external process, but it's the relationship between the internal and the external. And so if we, you know, kind of convey to a client only that we only want to talk about kind of your responsibility or, you know, kind of your, you know, psychological processes, I think that can sometimes be experienced by clients as invalidating perceptions they have of what's going on in the world that they live in. So, you know, the workplace or within the family system. And I think timing is important. So initially, if I'm working with a client who's doing a lot of externalizing, then that's saying to me, they need some space to talk about this for a bit before we, you know, kind of begin to look at their contribution.
So we start to see how both pacing and validation can be so crucial for effectively working with blame. When a client is doing a lot of externalizing, we might want to take that as a signal. It could be telling us that we need to slow down our pacing and readjust our focus. Again, if we move too quickly to examine the client's role in the problem, it can harm the therapeutic alliance. And with particular client populations, this can be especially painful.
One of the experiences I've had as an African-American woman, as a therapist, is sometimes clients are referred to me who have previously seen a white therapist and have said when they have found me that one of the experiences they had was not feeling validated for, you know, what they perceive happening in their lives in the world. Right. So in the workplace or in other settings, clients that I work with are often from historically oppressed or stigmatized groups, marginalized groups. And there's sometimes a wall that has gotten kind of erected to protect against those invalidations that they feel when someone says, oh, you're playing the race card, or, oh, you know, take some responsibility. Everything's not about, you know, discrimination or those kinds of things that they'll hear from the world that feel very invalidating, like, wait a minute, I have an actual experience here that needs to be heard. And I think as therapists, we don't want to repeat that invalidation. You know, when the client is saying, I have an actual experience that needs to be heard, we really need to hear that experience. And I think the more we do that, the wall that has kind of been built for protection can begin to come down. And then I think clients will hear us and be willing to do that hard work of saying, wow, what is my role in this? You know, really, what am I contributing to this?
Shelley just shared a critical perspective, especially when it comes to working with clients who are historically or oppressed or marginalized. So how can practitioners, especially perhaps those who aren't a member of those groups, how can practitioners navigate that dynamic?
Seek out resources where you are hearing about people's experiences that are different than your own so that, you know, in a therapeutic situation or for me in a classroom, you can start to recognize when people are saying something, how very likely it is that they are reporting it accurately rather than something like, oh, I'm sure it wasn't really about race, or maybe, you know, you're taking this too personally. And I actually wanted to share a quote from a paper that I'm going to send you, by the way, the paper So one way that you can start to educate yourself is just try to learn more about how people of different races experience things like microaggressions or micro injuries. So the paper is called Racial Microaggressions in Everyday Life, Implications for Clinical Practice. So it's specifically looking at people who are therapists, how to avoid doing it yourself and also understand other people's experiences that may be different from your own. And one quote from this is that the most accurate assessment about whether racist acts have occurred in a particular situation is most likely to be made by the most disempowered rather than by those who enjoy the privileges of power. And I think this is really important. And one of the things that that is brought up in this paper is that sometimes if we have had our own experiences of being marginalized or stigmatized, say, because you're a woman or because of your religion or because of your appearance or a disability, we think we understand what it's like to be oppressed for other reasons. And that not to make that assumption, that the person who understands the experience is the person who's had it. And that even just to make the assumption that because I'm a woman or because of some other factor, I know what it's like to be treated unfairly, and therefore I understand your experience of being a racial minority or something else, that is actually, that in itself can be a microaggression.
So just to recap, we want to be very cautious that we're not rushing a client to focus too quickly on their role in a problem. The danger here is that we could be invalidating their experience. See, in a general sense, when a client feels invalidated for any reason, they can become more prone to feeling blame or resentment, and that can just fortify the hidden pain that's linked to the blame. Now, as Dr. Rick Hansen discovered, sometimes this invalidation begins in the home.
In the case of this particular client, I'm going to deliberately use a gendered language here, a motherly impulse toward her children and a wifely impulse toward her husband. And a kind of deeply rooted reparative impulse grounded in being a daughter and being a girl. In her case, one of the things that were disowned in her was her anger at her own kids for refusing her help in some ways, or not being helpable, or being blaming her, even though she's the one who's really trying to help them and had in fact helped them in enormous, including very financially costly kinds of ways. And one of the secret aspects here was she was angry at him. She was mad at him. And being able to own that and include that was a really critically important part of the treatment. And I think sometimes it tends to be disowned and warded off and pushed aside. It leaks out a little bit, like, why won't they take my help? Harumph. But underneath that superficial exasperation is sometimes a deeply frustrated anger. And that was important to surface and acknowledge and bring into awareness and then understand and gradually disengage from.
Although it may have been difficult for Rick's client to accept at first, it's completely understandable why she'd be angry. But anger is often just the messenger. Underneath it are the painful emotions that can keep a client glued to their blame.
The anger is normal and often very valid for multiple reasons. The anger related to making efforts that didn't bear fruit, underneath which is, let's say, disappointment and sadness and grief. That's really important to deal with. And another part of it is sometimes the anger is very appropriate in that she had been let down or deceived sometimes by people in her family system who said, oh yeah, I'll change, or I'll do this thing that will make my life better if you only pay my rent for the next 6 months, or if only you help me find a better living situation. And then really what they were doing was taking advantage of her efforts. So yeah, there's a lot of often a legitimacy in the anger and naming that too. She was guilty about her anger, as I think many people are. It'd be more commonly mothers and fathers, perhaps, but she was quite guilty about it. And to validate the legitimacy of her anger was an important piece of the puzzle, too.
That's a unique part of blame that's worth noting. Clients can often feel guilty about having this anger. In these cases, the anger can simply get pushed underneath. But let's look a little closer now at one of the other emotions that Rick's client was struggling with, because I think it's important. So I'm going to start up above a little further. Let's look a little closely now. There. But let's look a little closer now at one of the other emotions that Rick's client was struggling with, because I think its importance can often be overlooked. In some cases, it can be the very thing that keeps blame alive and keeps a client from growing. And I'm talking about disappointment.
I think disappointment is an underappreciated therapeutic issue, clinical issue. Mm-hmm. And so what I think is helpful about that is to really be mindful of it and open to it and feel it, and also recognize that it's disappointment in relationship to a longing or a vision or a desire, a wish. And then what gets really interesting is to explore that wish, that longing, that dream. And sometimes what happens is people realize that they're disappointed in relationship to a dream or a fantasy that was really unrealistic or grandiose in some way. And realizing that kind of pops the bubble and can actually lighten up the disappointment. They realize, oh, that was kind of silly, understandable, grounded in childhood. I'm never going to be a rock star. I'm never going to get a Nobel Prize. But really, the odds of that are low anyway. I don't need to be disappointed about that. It's not a big deal.
This is another example of how we can bring the idea of unrealistic expectations to the client. Michael Yapko covered this in Module 2. Now, the flip side to this is that sometimes the client just can't brush aside that long-held desire. They can have a very difficult time even making contact with this internal longing.
On the other hand, sometimes there's a very, very important longing that people have sometimes suppressed in themselves because as soon as they feel the longing, then they start getting disappointed. And to realize, no, of course, you would wish to have had a healthy relationship with your own parents. Or of course, you would have wanted to have a life partner who truly, truly cherished you. And that's a deeply important thing to want, in a sense, intensifying or claiming the legitimacy of the longing is a necessary step in working through the disappointment.
This can be a valuable insight into just how much a client's longing and disappointment can get entangled with blame. I'd like to keep chewing on this idea. So in the next video, we're going to look at how to help resolve this kind of disappointment in order to bypass blame, and how this can help lead clients to growth. I'll see you there.